will tell us about the large D limit of matrix models.
All right, so thank you very much for this opportunity to present this, this talk here. So the, this talk is going to be quite general. It's more of an overview of many topics. However, I will try to give you also some of the details along the way. But tomorrow morning, I will give a blackboard talk in the string group. And there, maybe you can ask for more details if you like. The program of tomorrow's talk can be adjusted. So there will be three main parts in the talk. I will start trying to give you my point of view on the big picture. Then I will give you some details on the new large N and the new large D limits of the very general class of matrix tensor models that we developed in a paper in particular with Rivasso and Valette, but also you have other references. And then in the last part of the talk, I will explain how you can use these ideas to study the phase diagram of matrix quantum mechanics in the strongly coupled regime and find very interesting physical phenomena on these phase diagrams, some of which that can be interpreted in particular are as giving a quantum description of the phenomenon of gravitational collapse. And this is a work, a PRL with Tatsuo Azeyanagi and Fidel Chaposnik, and it's also work in progress with Fidel Chaposnik that will appear in the probably in the coming weeks. Okay, so the big picture, the central object of interest is the quantum black hole. And by quantum black hole, we mean that we want to emphasize the most puzzling aspects related to the unitarity puzzle, unitarity violation, the existence of quasi-normal modes, quasi-normal behavior, which is related to this unitarity violation, the presence of chaos, and in a sense, maximal chaos in the vicinity of black hole horizons, all the horizon physics, the description of the black hole interior, et cetera, et cetera. So these are the big questions in this field of quantum black holes. And the usual arena where you can actually describe in very explicit terms these phenomena in principle is string theory, deep brain physics, which are themselves related to matrix models, holography, etc. I put matrix models twice, I don't know if it's a mistake, but just maybe to emphasize that matrix models are very central in all this game. The reason why matrix models are so important from that point of view is very simple to understand, is just that open strings have two ends, and to each end is attached a Champaton factor, which transforms under some symmetry group. So because strings have two ends, the degrees of freedom associated with the strings are matrices with the two indices X, A, B. So when you have a string theoretic description, immediately you get matrix models. It's a completely generic feature of this approach. So that's the traditional starting point, maybe, to try to study these questions. Much more recently, seemingly entirely different starting point emerged following the insightful remarks by Kitayev. And this completely new starting point are very simple fermionic disordered models. So you start with systems of fermions, you put some interactions with very, very complicated couplings here, which are essentially picked randomly from some Gaussian distribution. And of course, you have many versions of the models, but this is the typical term in the Hamiltonian. And these super simple looking, they're both super simple looking models because they can be defined in a very elementary way. At the same time, they're very complicated because the couplings are random, so the Hamiltonian involves very complicated interactions. But these models, remarkably, display many features that are usually associated with black hole physics. And that includes, you know, the quasi-normal behavior and the chaotic behavior in particular. Because these are really non-trivial features, the fact that these models display them, you know, aroused a lot of interest in them, and you know, well, somehow these models are believed to capture an essential piece of the black hole physics. It might be very mysterious if you start from there, but it's just a fact. You can prove that these models are relevant. From this, you can, following a nice remark by Witten about a year ago, you can notice that a crucial ingredient in the solution of these models, and also in the way the physics, the interesting physics emerge in this model, is a particular structure of the Feynman graphs that you need to resum to get the solution. And this particular structure of the Feynman graph is called Milonic. What Witten noticed is that the Milonic graphs, or generalizations thereof, also play a role in so-called tensor models, where tensor models are models based on objects which have more than two indices. So two indices are matrix models. Three or more, you call them tensor models. So this is nice because it enlarges the applicability of the results that you have here. It is nice too because maybe tensor models are more usual models. They don't involve random interactions in particular. So they are genuine quantum mechanical models at finite end, et cetera, et cetera. They still remain quite mysterious from the point of view of matrix model. If you have an object with three indices, it's sort of very puzzling how you can make a link with string theory. Objects which have three ends are not easily depicted. So the link with string theory is very obscure, but still it's an interesting link that you can make here. So now the first part of the talk will be to try to explain that actually there is a natural link that you can make with matrix models too, and that all this story in particular of Milonic graphs or generalized Milonic graphs is also relevant for ordinary matrix models that you find in string theory constructions. So how does that come about? And it's actually quite natural. In string theory, a typical setup to build up a black hole would involve brains. So you have stacks of brains, and because the open strings join one brain to the other, you have two indices, this I and J. So that's what I was explaining before. Strings have two indices because they have two ends. However, when you have a brain construction, you always have transverse directions, direction transverse to the brains, which means that the models you construct always have some rotational symmetry associated with rotations in the directions transverse to the brain. In other words, the matrix model you have, you get in this construction, they always have an additional index that I call mu that label the direction transverse to the world volume of the brains. So this is actually a very natural thing that, that you find. And the number of dimension transverse to the brain, that I call capital D, is of course related to the total number of dimension in space-time, little d, and to the number of dimension on the world volume of the brain, which is typically fixed. P here is one or two, but it's a fixed number. Fine.
Sorry, so that gives you one extra index, right?
Sorry?
That gives you, in a sense, one extra index.
Absolutely.
In the tensor models that you had before,
yeah.
Did you always need three indices, or did you?
Well, these are no. You can have an arbitrary number of indices
right.
In the tensor model. You can have tensors of rank R, and we developed the theory also for. So there are the old models, the new models. They can be defined for.
The observation you're giving us now.
Yeah. Now, sort of from that point of view, three indices is singled out. Okay. But that's all you need at the end of the day to get the interesting physics you want to get. So this index mu, okay, transforms in this orthogonal group, as I said. And now you can have an idea that, well, why don't take the large D limit too? You have a matrix model, you're used to take the large N limit. Now you have an additional index mu. Why not consider a large D limit from string theory? It sounds strange, because in string theory, the number of space-time dimension is fixed, typically 10. You could say 10 is large. You know, so maybe the large D limit is a good approximation to this. Or you might have a more general point of view that these matrix models are actually well-defined, not only for D equal 6 or 7 or 8 or 9, but for any number of components. And so why not consider this large D limit? It's a very simple idea, but it's very naive when you think about it on the first analysis. The reason is that when you take large D, these objects, these variables, will behave as a vector of matrices. You know, the X mu ij, you can now think about them as a vector of D matrices. And the large D limit will then look very much like ordinary large D vector model that people have been studying for decades, starting from the 70s. Yeah. These are interesting objects. They played a role recently also in these higher spins, et cetera, et cetera. But still, we know that they are far too trivial to describe black holes. So, you know, large D vector models, they don't have quasi-normal modes. They're not black holes. They're far too trivial. And if you do the large D here in a naive way, even with matrices, you'll get some new version of the large D vector model with more indices. It will be a little bit more intricate, but essentially it will be the same for the physics you're going to extract as the physics you can extract from ordinary vector models. So that's not gonna work. That's too naive, that's too easy. Something new must happen. And okay, I will write this equation later again. So let me tell you now, so what is the new idea, the new twist in this story for the large D matrix? So let me write down a typical Lagrangian for matrix quantum mechanics. I could use field theories, it would be the same. Okay? The discussion would apply the same, but let's do quantum mechanics. So X's are complex here, complex matrices. These terms describe interactions. So for example, single trace terms with quartic interactions, etc. I will give you examples on the next slide. Here, I have scaled the variable such that both N and D appear in front of the Lagrangian. The usual large N limit, Toft-like, is N goes to infinity, keeping the couplings T's that appear here fixed. So with this scaling, the Toft limit, the TBs are the Toft coupling, like the guys that are kept fixed at large N. And the fact that I put D in front of the Lagrangian 2 means that the ordinary vector-like large D limit will also be traditionally defined by taking D goes to infinity at fixed TB. Okay, so these couplings T's are Toft couplings, but they're also fixed at large D in the standard large D limit. Now, and this is the crux of this subject, if you like, the point is that instead of taking large D at fixed TB, you may imagine to use an enhanced scaling, where TB now is not fixed at large D, but is some power of D, G of B will be some strictly positive number, times a coupling lambda B that will be kept fixed at large D. So you decide to enhance some coupling at large D, meaning that, okay, you're going then to keep more graphs, sort of, because you know, the couplings are enhanced, so when D goes to infinity, more graphs are possibly contributing. Okay, you could say, why not? But that sounds crazy at first. Indeed, the typical thing is that if you enhance a coupling, then you can build diagrams which have an arbitrarily high power of D, just by putting the vertex that you've enhanced an arbitrary number of times. So you will get typically graphs with arbitrary high powers of D, and then the large D limit doesn't exist anymore. You don't have a well-defined large D expansion. In other words, the Toft scalings in general are very delicate. You know, if some couplings are diminished, the limit becomes trivial because you kill all your graphs. But if some couplings are enhanced, you also kill the limit because some graphs explode. So the Toft scaling is usually a very delicate thing. So how is this idea here that I'm presenting could possibly make sense? Well, and so this is this red sentence. This is the main result. And the main result relies on the fact that we have a matrix vector. Okay, so a matrix of vectors. The property is as follows. The powers of D and N in a given Feynman diagram are not independent. So to define the enhanced large D limit, you're going to use the large N expansion. The intuition is as follows. Essentially, the power of D is related to the number of OD loops that you can draw on your Feynman graphs, that your Feynman graph has. But in the matrix model, the Feynman graph is itself drawn on a Riemann surface. So it can be viewed as the discretization of a Riemann surface. But on a Riemann surface of fixed genus, you cannot put loops in arbitrary ways. You have sort of a finite number of independent loops. So this intuition tells you that the power of D at fixed genus might be constrained. And indeed, this is what is happening in these matrix models. And I will give you a proof tomorrow. Today, I'm not going to give you a proof. I'm just going to describe the result. So the result, yes?
So in a sense, you're taking first the large N limit and then you take the large D limit?
Yeah.
What about if you switch the...
They don't commute. Okay. Absolutely. I'm going to emphasize that, but that's exactly what's happening. And that's the new feature. The old-fashioned large D would commute with the large N. The new large D does not commute with the large N, and that's the fundamental thing that makes it more interesting. Absolutely. So, examples. Imagine you have an interaction like this in your Lagrangian. Well, it turns out that this guy cannot be enhanced. There's no way. If you enhance it, the large D limit doesn't work. So this guy, you can include it, but it will be vector model-like. However, imagine now that you add a term like this, where the indices, the vector indices are sort of mixed. This interaction turns out to behave in a fundamentally different way than that interaction. And this interaction can be enhanced. It can be enhanced with a factor of square root of d. You can put an additional square root of d in front, and the large d limit will work. This guy can be enhanced with a factor of d, et cetera, et cetera. So you have rules that tells you, for a given interaction, what kind of power of d you can enhance the interaction with. And the final result is as follows. So you start with the standard large N expansion, which is the genus expansion here, for example, for the free energy. And then the new large d approximation is an approximation of the approximation, if you like. It allows you to expand at fixed genus as a series in 1 over square root of d. And the fact that this expansion works comes from the fact that at fixed genus, you can show that a given graph can be proportional at most to d to the power 1 plus g. So this is the signification of this formula. The highest power of d at fixed genus is bounded above by 1 plus g. So if you take into account all genera at the same time, the large d limit doesn't exist. So you cannot take large d before taking large n. That's the remark you made. However, if you take first large n, then you work at fixed genus, and you have this bound above that make it work. OK? So the lesson is that we learn that in matrix models, there is an interesting approximation as the series in powers in 1 over square root of d of the sum of graphs of fixed genus. For physics, the most interesting are the planar graphs, of course, but that works for any genus. So it's a new approximation for the sum of the planar diagrams, in particular. And the big thing is that it seems that this new approximation, albeit, quite simple in the sense that we will be able to resend the leading graphs, but it's much more complicated than the usual vector model. Okay, so it's sort of in between the difficulty of the sum over planar graphs, which we still don't know how to do, and the difficulty of vector model, which is too trivial. It's sort of in between, but it's still tractable and seems to capture correctly the qualitative physics which is associated with the full sum of a planar graph. So this is one of the main statements, is that this approximation will capture what is usually associated with the full sum of a planar graph, the quasi-normal behavior, the chaotic behavior, the horizon physics of black holes in particular. So this is what is super exciting, if you like, about this, is that it looks like we have an approximation of the sum of a planar graph, which is good enough to capture the essential physics of the planar graph. Okay. So any questions so far? So this closes the big picture sort of introduction of the talk.
Yeah? Dumb question. So if your third index transforms in the same way as the first two, does this result reduces to the one known for rank 3 tensor models?
So not they are closely related, but they are not exactly the same because they would reduce it if you take d equal n. So in the ordinary tensor model, you take d equal n, and n goes to infinity, which then mix up graphs from the matrix point of view of various genera, which is not natural at all from the string point of view, if you like. And so you don't have in the normal ordinary tensor models, you don't discuss bounds on the powers of D. So that's the difference. But otherwise, part of the techniques can be imported and used, adapted, etc. So there's a close relationship. And in particular, for example, if you want the three indices to be of very similar nature, instead of taking, for example, Hermitian matrices that transforms under UN with the OD index, you can also use real symmetric matrices, for example. And then the three indices will transform under an orthogonal group, and then it's more natural maybe to do D equal N. But the D equal N is very unnatural from the point of view of that I'm trying to develop today. Maybe a small point to emphasize along these lines, which is important, very important conceptually. In string theory, the group associated with the transformations of the Champaton factors are always gauge groups, which means that you need to gauge any, for example, UN symmetries that you have in these models. Whereas the OD symmetry is not gauged, of course, because in my interpretation, it's just a global symmetry, maybe the rotation transverse to the brains, but it's always a global symmetry. Whereas in tensor model, you wouldn't have any rational to decide, you know, to gauge maybe only two indices out of three or whatever. But here, my claim is that this is very important. On the other hand, since you take large N and large D, gauging at leading order plays no role. So it will be important at subleading, but it plays no role at leading order because the gauge group, the dimension of the gauge group is of order n, whereas the action have a d as well. So any contributions from Fadeyev, Popov, determinants, etc., if you like, will not have the d, of course. It will know only about the gauge group, which knows only about n. So at leading order, gauging doesn't play a role. But in principle and at subleading order, only the un is gauged. Okay. So far, so good for the difference between tensors and matrices. So now I want to give you a glimpse of some of the ideas involved and also emphasize the difference between what is useful for black hole, including in the tensor models, and the old sort of large N limit of tensor models developed by Razvan Guro originally. Okay, because there is a very important difference, actually. And that's what I want to explain. So maybe let's start with some graph theoretic ideas. So a graph, okay, it's just a set of vertices and edges that relate the vertices. When you draw a graph on your piece of paper, maybe without realizing it, you're actually giving more data than just the graph theoretic data. Because when you draw a graph on a sheet of paper, you automatically choose a particular cyclic ordering of the edges around each vertex that you draw. That's just by construction when you draw the graph on a piece of paper. So for example, you know, if you have four fields, 1, 2, 3, 4, you can draw it this way or that way, it will be the same. So this additional information is completely relevant for ordinary field theories. However, for matrix theories, that's exactly what you want. So Feynman graphs for matrix theories actually know about the cyclic ordering of the lines around the vertex because a single trace vertex knows about the cyclic ordering of the matrices in the trace. Okay, so because the matrices do not commute. That's why Feynman graphs for matrices are actually graphs drawn on a surface. And that's where the idea of Toft comes from, if you like, in modern language. And that's where this ribbon fat graph representation comes from. Fine. So, well, really, for a graph drawn on a surface, you need, so you have this cyclic ordering which plays a role around the vertices, and also you have actually another information, which is the type of edge, which can be plus or minus. Plus would be an ordinary ribbon, relevant, for example, for Hermitian matrices, but you could also choose a minus, which in the ribbon representation means you decide to twist your ribbon. And that this sort of graphs play a role, for example, for symmetric for real matrices. All right. Okay, so the lesson here is that when you draw a graph on a surface, on top of the graph theory data, you have to specify the cyclic ordering of the edges around the vertices and the type of vertex of edge that you use, twisted or untwisted. That's the first idea. Another idea coming from matrix, ordinary matrix models. So when you have an ordinary matrix model, I want to describe what happens when the interactions are not only single trace, but can be multi-traces. Maybe the single trace case is very, very well known by everybody. Multi-trace case, maybe not everybody knows about. So when you have a multi-trace interaction, imagine, for example, trace x squared interaction, the correct Toft scaling involves here an additional factor. So you need sort of to reduce by this TA, which is the number of traces. So if it's a single trace term, TA is 1, you don't have that. But for double trace, you will have a 1 over n here, et cetera. Okay? So you need this in order for the large n limit to make sense. This is well known, of course. And when you do that, these multi-trace matrix models still have a nice large n expansion of this form. But now h here, the integer h, is no longer just the genus. It's the genus of the graph plus some contribution where the TAs are the number of traces in the vertices that appear in the graph, and B is the number of connected components of the ribbon graph. The ribbon graph, indeed, even if the Feynman graph is connected, the ribbon graph for a multi-trace matrix model does not need to be connected. It's very clear, for example, you can have a vertex like this, which even though it's a unique vertex from the Feynman graph point of view, from the ribbon graph point of view, these two pieces here are not connected to each other, so they might produce disconnected Riemann surfaces. Fine. On the other hand, it's very easy to understand because the number of connected components in the graph that you can produce, of course, is sort of bounded above by the number of multi-trace vertex that you have in the graph, that the quantity that you have here is always positive. So this h is the sum of the genus, which is always positive, plus another number, which is always positive, and so this expansion works very well. But the lesson here is just to recall, for multi-trace matrix models, the integer that classifies the graphs in the large n expansion is not just the genus, it's the genus corrected by this guy here. Okay? Fine. That's another information. Third information, D-bubbles. So D-bubbles are regular graphs. Regular means that the number of edges attached to vertices is always the same, with colored edges. So each edge is colored, and the edges attached to a given vertex all have different colors. So you cannot have two edges with the same color attached to the same vertex. This is actually a nice representation of a tensor, here with four indices. You just decide that each of the index, each time you have a tensor, you have a vertex, and each of the index is associated with a particular color and a particular leg here. With this drawing, interaction vertices for tensors of rank R are automatically R bubbles. So for example, if you look at a term like this, written in matrix form, but think about it in terms of tensors. So the x mu is x a b mu. The index a, let's say, are the green colors, the index b are the red colors, the index mu are the black colors. Here you have four x's, so four vertices, and I join the vertices according to the way the indices are contracted. This gives me a unique graphical representation of the vertex, and vice versa, so it's a unique thing. So this term called non-melonic is this is the melonic, is this, etc., etc. So you have a colored graph representation of interaction vertices in these models. Moreover, the Feynman graphs themselves for tensors of rank R are also bubbles, but R plus one bubbles. And the idea is very simple. When you have Feynman graphs, you just build a Feynman graph by picking up vertices, which, as we have seen in the previous slides, are bubbles, and then you join the vertices with propagators. Well, just decide that the propagators is just a new color, color zero. And then with this new color, it's clear that the full Feynman graph is also a bubble. So that's nice. Fine. Now comes the crux of all this business of large N, large D in this language. To have a well-defined large N, you need to have an integer that will classify the graph in the large N expansion. And this integer must be positive. That will tell you that there is a good 1 over N expansion. So you need to find ways, natural ways, to assign integers to graphs, and then try to define a large N limit where these integers will indeed show up and govern the large N expansion. And essentially, we'll see that you have two distinct ways to associate a positive number to any colored graph, two distinct ways, which are both very natural. So one way uses this notion of jacket. There are many ways to draw a colored graph on a surface, just because of what I said a few minutes ago. Essentially, you need to pick a cyclic ordering of the colors around each vertex. And you need to decide which edges are twisted or untwisted. So a very nice way to do that is you say, okay, you have a set of colors, choose some particular cyclic ordering first, and second, choose types for vertices. You can pick vertices of type 1 and vertices on type 2. And then you decide that edges joining vertices of different types are untwisted, and edges joining vertices of the same time are twisted. That's just a rule, and using this rule, you can draw any given colored graph on a surface. Okay? If you do that, since the graph is drawn on a surface, you can compute the genus of the surface. So for each jacket associated with the graph, each drawing of the graph on the surface, you have a genus. And then you can sum over all the possibilities, sort of sum over all the cyclic orderings that you might choose. That's very natural thing to do. The result is called the degree of the graph, introduced first by Gureau and Rivasseau. That's the degree, what we call the degree of a colored graph. The graphs of degree zero are called melons. That's the abstract definition of a melon. Maybe a better name would be superplanar, because you see that graphs of degree zero means that all their jackets are planar. It means that whatever choice you make to draw the graph on the surface is always planar, is always a sphere. That's quite remarkable. You know, these are graphs, even if you change the cyclic ordering, well, they're still planar. It's a very special set of graphs, so superplanar graphs or melons. Excellent. So this is the degree, very natural. Yet, there is a completely different and a natural way to assign also a positive number to a colored graph. And this second way will use matrix model ideas. So how can you do? You have a Feynman graph, which is a colored graph. So you have the lines of color zero, they are the propagators, keep those. And then pick two colors. In other words, choose in your tensor two particular indices. You decide that these indices are singled out. From that point of view, the tensor model becomes a matrix model. You know, you single out two indices, if you like, you decide that these are the two indices of the matrix, and the other indices are, you know, let's say, additional symmetry indices that you discard. From the point of view of the colored graph, what does it mean? It means that you have your Feynman graph, you remove all the edges except the edge of the two colors that you've singled out on top of the color zero, which are the propagators. When you do that, of course, you get a normal matrix model graph. You get a matrix model graph. And so you can associate to it a genus. Or more naturally, this number H that we have described before, which governs the large N expansion of the matrix model that you get from the tensor model by picking up two indices. It's important to keep the H with this additional term because it's very easy to realize that when you have a tensor model, even if you have a connected bubble describing the interactions, when you single out only two indices, typically the resulting term in the matrix model language will be multitrace. It's very natural. So multi-trace matrix models, when you do that in tensors, they show up in a very, very natural way. So it's natural to have this H, okay, which is the positive number. Now, okay, once you've done that, you can sum up over all the H's for all the choice of pairs of indices, so all the possible matrix models that you can embed in your tensor model. And this sum, we call that the index. That's the definition we gave in this paper with Rivasu and Valette. That's the index of the graph. Very natural way to do it from the matrix model point of view. Okay. Now, how are these two quantities, the degree on one hand and the index on the other hand, going to appear here in the large N limit? All this will depend on the way you're going to define your large N limit. How are you going to scale your couple? So let's take a model like this, which is very general set of interactions. And we have here put the factors of n in, and d in the standard way. So the factors of n are just the usual Toft scaling that we, of course, we're not going to modify. But then you have the couplings tau a. If you scale the tau a's in this way, so you're going to take large d, with d, okay, this is proportional to t of ba, which is the number of traces. C of ba, forget about it, let's say it's one. C of ba is the number of connected components of the bubble ba, which describes the interaction term in the tensor model. So these guys could be connected in a lot of models, they're connected, but in general, they don't need to be connected. So if they're not connected, you have to put this. But here, what is important is this factor. So you scale the tau a according to the degree of the interaction bubble. Okay, this defines the scaling. It's the so-called Bonzon-Guro-Rivasso scale. This is how tensor models were originally defined, so-called uncolored general tensor models. This is how they were defined. You take this. So for example, a term like this will be scaled like 1 over d. A term like this will not be scaled. There will be no scaling. And the remarkable result then of the analysis is that Feynman graphs turn out to be proportional to, well, the factor of n is the standard one, standard matrix model one, and the power of d is r plus h minus l, where l is essentially the degree of the graph, plus an additional term which comes from the fact that, that you might have disconnected components. But if all the tensor model interaction terms are connected, this is zero. Okay, so in a lot of models, this is just zero. And then the expansion is entirely governed by the degree of the Feynman graph. So that's the Bonzon-Guro-Rivasso tensor model definition. remarkable. The scaling of the coupling constants refer to the degree of the interaction bubble, and the resulting large N expansion is itself governed by the degree, but not of the Feynman graph. Very beautiful result. And of course, then, the leading graphs are the graphs of degree zero, the Mellons. Very nice. When people proposed this first, it was a big, in the community, I think, of tensors and quantum discrete quantum gravity, it was a very big result, because for many years, people believed that this sort of models, you could just not define any interesting large N limit. And the fact that a nice structure like this existed was a very non-trivial advance in this field. However, from the point of view of the string theorists or, you know, black hole physics, blah, 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 this sort of limit is too simple. Essentially, the graphs or the Mellonic graphs that you resum like this are very much like vector model graphs. And if you solve the tensor models using these scalings and this theory, you're not going to get SYK-like physics or black hole physics. Okay. So that's a bit disappointing. And what you need is a different scaling of the couplings. So what you need is not saying tau A is equal to this, and take large D at fixed mu A, as Bonzon, Gureau, and Rivasso did. What you need is a new scaling, and that's the one we defined in this paper in last year, where the coupling is enhanced. You see that instead of minus something proportional to the degree, now you have plus something proportional to the degree. So the new limit is enhanced. It's going to keep many more graphs. It's going to be more complicated in this sense. At any order in 1 over n, you're going to get more graphs because we've enhanced some vertices. So that's in these limits, that's where this vertex comes with the square root of d, whereas in the previous one, it was like 1 over d, so it was suppressed. Now it comes with the square root of d. This one doesn't change. In the previous limit, this sort of vertices actually could not contribute to leading order. Only these guys were contributing to leading order. That's why it was like a vector model. Now with the enhancement, these so-called non-Mellonic interactions, because the degree of the bubble here is actually strictly positive, these non-Mellonic interactions can contribute to leading order. So you have many more graphs with these vertices that can contribute. So that's nice. But now, of course, the big question, as I said before, that's a generalized version now, is, well, if you enhance coupling, how do you know that the limits exist? In principle, it should kill everything. Some graphs with arbitrary high powers of n and d should show up. So that's what you have to prove, and that's what we prove in the paper, that with this, the limits still exist, but now it is governed not by the degree of the Feynman graph, but by the index of the Feynman graph. Okay, so that's the fundamental new result in the paper. The new large N expansion is governed by the index of graphs, not by the degree of graphs. So graphs of degree zero have index zero, but the converse is not true. So we've called generalized Mellons the graphs of index zero, and you have many more than the ordinary Mellons. Because of this, the expansion is more interesting and can yield SYK-like physics, if you like, in terms of this. All right. So just to highlight a few other points in this work, the work points to making, well, some particular interactions are singled out by our results. These are the interactions which we call maximally single trace, which are the interactions which, so you take an interaction term in the tensor model, and as I explained, for our point of view, you're going to consider it as a matrix model interaction for all the matrix models that you can embed in the tensor model. The maximally single trace interaction terms are the tensor model interaction terms for which all the matrix models that you can use to write the term always yield single trace interaction terms. in the matrix model language. So you have tensor model interaction. Whatever way you want to rewrite it in terms of matrices by picking up two indices, you always get a single trace matrix model interaction pair. On the bubble representation, it is just saying that you have exactly one cycle of alternating colors in the graph. So consider, for example, this example, and consider cycles where you alternate blue and green. Start here. Blue, green, blue, green, blue, green, blue, green, that's it. You have only one like that. And this blue-green cycle will actually yield a trace if you write the interaction terms in terms of the matrix obtained by singling out the blue and green indices. And if it's always single trace, it means that whatever two indices you pick, two colors you pick, you get only one cycle. So these are the maximally single trace interactions. They are very, very interesting objects. So this is one example, one of the examples. And an outstanding open problem in this field will be to describe in full generality the graphs of index zero, the generalized Mellons, for maximally single trace interaction tensor models. So it's a very big, very interesting problem. Can we classify the generalized Mellons for maximally single trace interactions? In the problem, in the paper, we've solved this problem for a particular case of complete color graph when the rank is a prime number. So, for example, this case is solved in the paper and generalizations thereof. But the general problem is very difficult, and it's a nice open problem. Okay, so I finish now with what I wanted to say about graphs and tensors and matrices, and maybe tomorrow I will show you a bit more.
So do these have any geometric interpretations, these index zero objects?
So for me, the interpretation I emphasized was the matrix model interpretation. So it's the usual, you know, sum over genera. If you want to come back to tensor models, now you take seriously the fact that you have three indices and you want to the three indices to play equivalent roles, then yes, you can have also an interpretation in the way that people in discretized quantum gravity did many years ago in terms of, you know, tetrahedra or higher dimensional simplices building up a higher dimensional discrete geometry.
The Mellon graphs are these kind of stacked spheres, right? You have an
idea. Yeah. Ah, yeah.
So what are
for generalized, okay, that I don't know. That I don't know. The point, but that's related to what I was just saying, is that we don't know actually how to classify the generalized Mellons in general. So I believe that for the case of maximally single trace interactions, it might be feasible and a very nice problem to solve. But it's not known, actually. So your question is very good, and I cannot answer for the moment.
So they might be also very degenerate objects from that point of view, but you don't,
yeah.
Simply don't know.
I simply don't know. I know how to do, oops. You know, a model like this, I know. And the reason I know is that the graphs, even though they're not Mellons, they have a Mellonic, let's say, a generalized Mellonic structure. They can still be built recursively with generalized Mellonic moves. So they're not Mellons in the strict sense, but the theory to classify this is some generalization, but it's not a big leap forward compared to, that's why we are able to do it. The full problem of generalized Mellons, I think, is some really non-trivial leap forward if we want to do it. I think it might be possible, but it's hard and open question. Yes?
It sounds like you, I'm just following up on this, it sounds like you know some of these generalized Mellon graphs. You may not classify them all, but you know.
In a model like this one, I know.
So then you can ask what's the geometrical interpretation?
Yes,
particular one.
That's right. I think there, because it is built recursively, we didn't think about it in this terms, but I think because they're built recursively in a way very similar to the ordinary Mellons, I don't know if they're stacked spheres, but they're going to be objects of the same sort.
kind of polymeric object.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not going to be a fundamentally new set of things. It would be very interesting to solve the problem in cases where it might be genuinely new, genuinely more complicated. That I cannot. All right. And any other question on graphs? All right. So now I think I have 10 minutes. Is that correct? I don't know when we started, actually. I didn't check out. It's about 10 minutes? Yeah. So I cannot give more a lot of details, but I think tomorrow morning maybe I will emphasize more this aspect. Let me describe what kind of things that you can do with all these techniques. So let's pick this model. So the psis are matrices, fermionic matrices. So I'm just using, you know, I quantize just by using the ordinary fermionic anti-commutation relation, and I'm taking just this nice-looking Hamiltonian here. And I'm studying it in the large N and large D limit. So I put this fundamental square root of D enhancement here. So the limit is taken at fixed capital lambda when D goes to infinity. What is the string interpretation of a very simple Hamiltonian like this? Well, I told you the indices of the matrices are the endpoints of strings. The model here is special because actually each of the index is associated with a UN symmetry. So you have really a UN cross UN symmetry. That's why the reason is because we have here psi, psi dagger, psi, psi dagger. I will show you later, or maybe tomorrow, a model which doesn't have this structure. For example, you can have psi, 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 psi dagger. Then you won't have UN cross UN. But here you have UN cross UN, so the two indices are different. In string theory language, you would say, well, we have two different sort of brains. Let's say the green brains and the red brains. And this is a special model where the strings are such that they can join only the green brains to the red brains. Okay, so you don't have strings, you don't have green-green strings or red-red strings. You only have green-red strings. Okay, it's a special setup, but still quite stringy. A very important piece of intuition comes from the interpretation of this parameter m, this mass parameter here. So this small m is actually equal to the capital M. That's a typo. The m gives the energy or the mass of the excitation of a string, at least at weak coupling. Okay? Because, well, if you apply the operator psi dagger on a state, you're going to create essentially an additional string which will have mass m. In string theory, the mass of a string is proportional to its length, coefficient of proportionality being the string length. So in string theory, the interpretation of this parameter would be the distance between the brains. If m is very large, the brains are very far apart, so the strings that must join one brain to another are very massive, because they are very long. And if the mass is decreased, then the strings will become lighter and can be excited in an easier way, and so on and so forth. Okay? So that's the brain interpretation of a Hamiltonian like this. This being said, let's try to study the model. I won't give any technical details, of course, but you know, I think I have time at least to flash the physics. So the parameters you have, this mass, the coupling lambda, and the temperature. So you have two dimensionless parameter, little m and little t. So we're going to be in unit where, let's say, capital lambda, the interaction is one, and we study the phase diagram as a function of this mass and the temperature in units of lambda. Fine. Let's start in this regime. Very small mass or zero mass, and very high temperature. At very high temperature, fermions are always perturbative, unlike bosons. But fermions at high temperature, you always have the perturbation theory. The intuition behind that, for example, is that if you go to the Euclidean, you know that fermions become antiperiodic, so there is a thermal mass associated with with them. And when the temperature is very high, the thermal mass is very high. So all the modes effectively are very massive, and you can define a perturbation theory. This regime here is a perturbation theory very much like the perturbation theory that you have in the SYK model. It's completely similar. So you can study the model perturbatively here. High temperature fermionic model. There's another perturbative regime in this phase diagram, which is very different from this one. It's the regime where the temperature is fixed, it might even be zero, but the mass parameter, the explicit mass parameter, is very large. So the brains are very far apart. Then all the strings are very massive, and this is just the standard textbook, I would say, perturbation theory around the Fock vacuum. You know, when the mass is very, very large, essentially the ground state of the system is just the Fock vacuum, and you can perturb around this. That's the normal perturbation theory. Good. So the effective coupling in this problem is the minimum of 1 over m and 1 over t. At high temperature, it's always perturbative because you get the thermal mass, but at high mass, it's also perturbative because that's just an explicit mass term. So all this region here is perturbative. Fine. Here, what is the entropy? Well, the entropy at very large temperature, of course, is log 2 per degrees of freedom, because essentially, at super high temperature, the state is essentially the maximally entropic state. It's, the density matrix is proportional to the density, so you get maximal entropy. What is the entropy here? Well, of course, it's zero. Here, at very low temperature and large m, you have a unique vacuum, the Fock vacuum. Entropy is zero. What is the entropy here? So this is a priori very hard, because now you're going to strong coupling. But as I said, in this regime, you're in the SYK regime. The model is very similar to the SYK model. So you can actually, remarkably, analytically compute the entropy at zero temperature here. And you find a non-zero result in terms of the Catalan number, this curious formula here. So the entropy at zero temperature and zero mass is non-zero. And that's one of the salient features of the SYK model that is shared by this matrix model too. Okay, so this is a fundamental aspect of the large N limit that you get this non-zero entropy at zero temperature. That's why it can describe the black hole, an extremal black hole. The extremal black hole has zero temperature, but a finite size horizon. We know it must have a macroscopic entropy. And so any model describing this sort of object must have a non-zero entropy at zero temperature. And that's exactly what you get here. Excellent. So going from here to there, it's non-trivial. But it's your recent perturbation theory. I would say it's not mysterious because it's like SYK. So now we start to understand what's going on.
So just a quick clarification. This zero temperature entropy is for a range of m or small, like for which?
Yes, this is at leading order at large n and large d.
But for, sorry, in m, you know at large m it's going to zero, and then this is
for, yeah.
This is for small m, or is this for?
No, so this result is for zero m. And for small m, you can compute it.
It's going to go down.
It goes down, but it's still non-zero. But actually, okay, I guess maybe what you want to say is this, is that here it's not mysterious. Here it is mysterious. Because here, you need to understand what's going on when you go from a regime where the matrix model is perturbative in the ordinary sense, with the ground state being just an ordinary Fock vacuum, completely trivial, to a regime where this non-zero entropy develops and all the other marvelous features of SYK develop, chaos and blah, blah, blah. Something must happen. And essentially, it's this puzzle that triggered this work that we did. You know, people focused before entirely on SYK, which is sort of this regime. But it's very natural here to have also this regime. Actually, this regime is even more natural. That's how you define usually your matrix model. You know, the Feynman graphs and the planar graphs are usually defined around this point, and then you want to resend them and see what happens. So that's actually more natural than high temperature fermions. Maybe not for condensed matter physicists, but from the string theorist point of view or quantum field theorist point of view, it's more natural to start from there. But then going from there to here is very strange. It's very mysterious. What's happening here? What about the brain interpretation? That's a very interesting interpretation to have. Well, we've said that the mass parameter is the distance between the brains. So at very large mass, this standard perturbative regime, yes, it's just the regime where the strings are not excited because the brains are so far apart that to excite a string requires a lot of energy. So you don't excite, you almost don't excite the string, the vacuum is just the Fock vacuum, and you have very small perturbations around that. That's the normal perturbation. And now you want to decrease n, which means that the brains, you bring them together, and something must happen. Something drastic must happen, because you know that eventually you're going to go to a regime, in particular, of non-zero, zero temperature entropy. Well, I think it's clear, if you have the brain and the gravity interpretation in mind, that what might happen is gravitational collapse. If you bring these two stacks of brain together, eventually you expect, certainly, to have gravitational collapse. So creation of a black hole, and the creation of a black hole is exactly sudden apparition of a macroscopic entropy. When you have a macroscopic horizon that is created in space-time, you associate to this phenomenon the appearance of macroscopic entropy. So these models could be relevant to describe the gravitational collapse phenomenon. Okay, I cannot explain this because I think I'm going to run out of time, but that's the result. So that's the final shape of the phase diagram. What are these? So this is the perturbative regime I discussed. The solution that describes this perturbative regime, it turns out that it exists, so you can solve the equation, the Schrödinger-Dyson equations, et cetera, that allow you to resend the perturbation theory. And it exists up to some minimal mass. So if you are given temperature, the solution will exist up to some minimal mass, and then you don't find it anymore. So it's like, you know, you resend your perturbation theory here, then you continue it to small mass, to stronger and stronger coupling, but at some point, the solution no longer exists. It's like you have a root, the super simple analog of this is when you have a root of an algebraic equation, it exists, but you change the parameters in the algebraic equation, and suddenly the root becomes complex. So when I say it doesn't exist, it's not that it doesn't exist. It no longer satisfies the unitarity constraint. So you know, for example, that the two-point function must be real. Then there's no real solution here. You have an imaginary one. It violates unitarity. Okay? So that's what happens for the perturbative solution. Now, here, if you start in this regime, you know it's like SYK. So you're going to have a solution describing SYK-like physics. And indeed, you find it. But you find that it exists up to some maximal mass described by this other dashed line here. The result is that there is, in this edge-shaped region here, there is a region where actually two solutions of your Schrödinger-Dyson equations coexist. Two physically sensible solutions coexist. And so they are in competition. And the one who wins is the one who has the less free energy. And this is this thick line. This thick line, so this is coexistence of two solutions, and this thick line describes a first-order phase transition when one solution suddenly becomes favored in terms of free energy compared to the other. And this first-order phase transition, we interpret this as the gravitational collapse, a version of gravitational collapse in the particular model that I've been considering here. So this is what happens. You have other very interesting features. This line of transition actually terminates. And it terminates at a critical point. So it's a non-trivial critical point in quantum mechanics, large N quantum mechanics, very similar to the critical point you have in the phase diagram of water, if you like, you know, when you have the first order phase transition between liquid water and vapor water, and that ends at a critical point, and this is very similar. Which means that you can actually smoothly go from the standard perturbative regime to the black hole regime, but at the expense of going to high temperature. And you can do that then in a smooth way. Okay, this is just a curve showing how the entropy varies as function of the mass. So this is zero entropy, and this is the creation of the black hole and the horizon. And here, it's not completely zero, because in our simulation, you can never go to exact strictly zero temperature. So you can do very small temperature, but not strictly zero. And that's why. But otherwise, it would be a jump here, and then you'd have a curve like that. These are graphs that describe the properties of the critical point. So you can compute critical exponents associated with the critical points. It's interesting, but I don't have time to emphasize this here. You can study other models. So, you know, other models, for example, still with the mass term, but now instead of having UN cross UN symmetry, just have a UN symmetry. So a term like this, instead of psi psi dagger, you study this. And the results, so these are plots for the entropy as function of mass. And you see that there's something very similar to what we had before. So this is the blue curve is for very low temperature. You have the perturbative regime, and you have a horizon that is created. The difference with the previous model is that now it's a smooth, it's not a first order transition. It's actually a quantum critical point. So this model doesn't have the first order phase transition. It has the quantum critical point describing the emergence of a macroscopic entropy and horizon. So that's another version. It has also many other interesting features. But okay, this is the main point here. And I can also talk about bosonic models, but I think I will do that only after the talk, if people are interested, or tomorrow, or informally. So I think it's a good moment to stop. I think I went 5 minutes late already. So thank you very much.
Question?
Yes.
So if you show the function of the entropy as a function of m, and it looks pretty much
this one?
The previous one. The entropy is your order parameter for the transition. Do you have like a symmetry breaking?
Well, here it's, you know, it's so in this model,
is it?
It's a first order phase transition. So, you know, that's why the entropy jumps.
Okay.
And, you know, many quantities will jump. In this model, yes, in this model, you could use more the zero temperature entropy as the order parameter. Because in this model, indeed, above the transition entropy is zero, below the transition entropy is non-zero. The same is true, of course, before, but here it's less trivial because it's continuous. It's not a first order phase transition. So yes, here the entropy plays the role, the macroscopic entropy plays the role of an order parameter.
Okay, and for that particular case, is there like any symmetry argument to see why in one side should be zero and the other one doesn't?
The only, no. I think symmetries do not, as far as I understand, I don't see any symmetry associated with this passage here. To me, it's like, you know, if you believe in this interpretation, that this is a version of gravitational collapse, you don't say it's a symmetry thing. But it's true that at some point, a horizon shows up. A horizon is created. So entropy, macroscopic entropy is created.
How about translational symmetry?
Sorry?
Translational symmetry. I mean, if the black hole is present, it breaks the translational symmetry.
So you mean in time?
In space.
But it could,
why? No.
I mean, I'm just proposing it, just a thought.
If it's translationally invariant, does entropy has to be zero? And if you break it, does it start? Or
not necessarily in general, maybe, but in this case, it just looks like this.
I don't think here you have translational.
Well, I don't really understand, maybe because I came late, I don't really understand the physical picture. But you have an external time, is that right?
I have time.
But your time is just a parameter. It's not. You're not reconstructing space-time from the
space here would be, the space coordinate, if you like, would be the mass. That describes the distance between the matter that you have in your problem.
No, but I'm just trying, going back to a very general question. What's the relation of this model to space-time? That's really what I'm asking.
Yeah.
So I think you have time. Time is built in.
Time is built in.
Externally.
And space.
Space is. Yeah.
Tomorrow I could explain actually. So I have in mind tomorrow to explain so half of my talk on how to find space in these models. But the lore here is that the dual to this is some ADS2 spacetime. Okay. So you have an ADS2 spacetime, which describes
spacetime.
Yeah.
So space is just one-dimensional.
Space is one-dimensional and time. So you have one emerging dimension. You have one emerging dimension. That's what you expect for quantum mechanical models. So you have quantum mechanics. The holographic version will have a radial emerging dimension. This radial emerging dimension here is sort of this M, if you like. But that's not very precise. I will try to make it more precise tomorrow. But if you like, the picture is that you have so ADS2 is like, if you stick in the Euclidean, for example, so ADS2 is like a ball, and you know the circle is the boundary, and so the circle is like the Euclidean time, and the radial direction is the emerging space.
Okay.
And the black hole sits in there. So the black hole is like a Rindler wedge in the ADS2, if you go now to real-time ADS2. So this is the interpretation that you can have. But here I'm very fast. If you don't know the picture, it's very hard to understand. But I can tell you more, if you like, in private, how this works.
OK. So I was just trying to make this suggestion. In your ground state, say your vacuum or whatever, no black hole, what do we have? We have a circular space. In the Lorentzian picture, what do we have? Do we have space represented by a circle now, or space is a...
No, so if you stick to the quantum mechanics, you don't have space. You know, this quantum mechanical model here has only time.
But you're talking about black holes.
Yes, so the black hole is like, it's the usual holographic setup. So in holography, you have a quantum mechanical model.
I think I'm asking about the dual picture. What do you expect to be seeing in the bulk?
A black hole. So in the bulk, it's an ADS2 black hole. So that's what it is in these models. So that's what it's been discussed. It works very well. So if you compute, I don't know, quasi-normal modes from these models, you can match them with the quasi-normal modes you compute for the ADS2 black hole. If you compute the chaos exponent, that was actually the beginning of this story.
I guess you must have a dilaton or something. I don't know.
That's right. So the gravity, yeah. Because in ADS2, if you want to have something non-trivial, it's a dilatonic. So it's this Jacquive-Teitelbaum sort of model. Yes.
Yes. So.
So the dilaton, The dilaton, what the dilaton is telling you is that in the radial direction, at some point you reach a regime where the gravity approximation is not going to work anymore. And that's perfectly consistent with the fact that these models are quantum mechanical, which means that at very high energies, they're always asymptotically free. At very high energies, it's like they're perturbative. So very high energy should be the boundary of ADS space. But if it's perturbative, you know that you're not in the strong coupling region where gravity approximation can work. So the consequence of this is that in the gravitational description, you do have a dilaton, which tells you that you have to put a cutoff in ADS2. So that's why people call this near ADS2 holography, if you want to be very precise. So it's holography in ADS2 with a cutoff that must be maintained. But that's irrelevant for black hole physics because the black hole is deep in the interior, if you like it. The black hole physics is dealing with the infrared behavior of the model that has nothing to do with the asymptotically free region.
You have sort of two infinities, is that right?
That's right.
So before you have the black hole, it seems to me maybe you do have some sort of spatial translation invariance. And when the black hole condenses or forms, it has a definite location semi-classically. So I'm just suggesting this off the top of my head as an answer to the what symmetry.
I think what you're saying is that, you know, if you have brains but you don't have interactions between the brains, it can move, and of course you'll have the translations. But then you don't, you know, it's. But that, I don't think that's going to help in understanding these sort of transitions here. Well, I could tell you much more about this transition. Much, much more about this transition, but maybe tomorrow I will, if you're interested. Here, that was just flashing some very basic results. But we're working very hard to work out a lot of the structure here. For example, just one word. One of the interesting quantity you want to compute are this Lyapunov exponent associated with chaotic behavior. We know that when you have a black hole, the Lyapunov saturates a bound. So it's a universal, it's a beta over 2 pi, it's a universal number. When you don't have the black hole, you don't expect chaos at zero temperature. When you turn on the temperature, you'll have chaos, but it will be very small compared to the black hole. This means that if you compute the Lyapunov exponent at very low temperature in this model, you get, let's say, essentially zero here, and then suddenly you get one in the units of the bound. Okay, so the one means the bound is saturated. So you get a curve like zero, and then it jumps to one. That would be at strictly zero temperature. If you're at very small temperature, the curve is smoothed out. You know, that's something we're working on now, which is very fascinating. So this is mass, and this is the Lyapunov in units of the bound. So the zero temperature is this, and this is here the quantum critical point. At very small temperature, you'll get something like that. In other words, the slope here goes to infinity when the temperature goes to zero. This suggests that this transition is characterized by a critical exponent for the Lyapunov, for the slope of the Lyapunov. That just to give you another one of the ideas we're trying to push right now, to find new kind of informations about quantum critical phase transitions based on this chaotic behavior. And it looks like there is really something very interesting happening here. So that's one example. And in the gravity picture, it's just you don't have a horizon, so it's ordinary, if you like Newtonian physics, it's absolutely not chaotic, and suddenly you get a black hole, and you know then you get chaos. And the transition is sort of like very singular, and that could be associated with critical exponents, et cetera, et cetera. I could keep going for...
Well, we have to say something for tomorrow, so...
That's right. Okay.